The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the last few weeks I've been talking about the Buddha's teaching on not self. And I'll continue today. Last week I talked a little bit about how we can begin to explore this in our experience through mindfulness. What are the Buddhist teachings on this exploration? So for those of you who haven't been here, I'll just give a little bit of a discussion about what this teaching is to begin with. So the teaching of not self is often taught along with two other aspects of experience that are considered universal characteristics of everything that we experience. So everything we experience, all of our sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, everything that comes up in our mind, everything that we experience moment to moment has three characteristics that mark every experience. That everything we experience is impermanent. It has this characteristic of flux, of change. Now that one isn't something that's so surprising to people, but as we begin to touch into our actual experience, the actuality of what is happening moment to moment, this characteristic of impermanence takes on quite a different flavor than we normally think about it. It shows itself to be a very rapidly changing experience. Nothing that we experience actually lasts longer than a split second. Everything is just essentially coming and going, coming and going, and coming and going. And there are processes in our mind that put things together. Processes that understand all of this kind of rapidly fluctuating information and put it into something that we see out there as relatively stable. So these processes are the processes of feeling, of the understanding of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, the process of perceiving, the process of recognizing what we are experiencing. That's actually a big one in terms of stabilizing our experience, the process of recognizing. We match our experience against what we know, what we remember, and recognize it. Through the process of language, through the process of learning, essentially, from the time that we're children. So this is the process of perception, of recognizing experience. And the process of knowing, the process of just meeting, the just kind of the bare meeting of experience, just that we know that we're hearing, we know that we're seeing, we know that we're thinking, but not so much. It's not about these three separate processes: feeling, perceiving, knowing. They're kind of different aspects of how we take in experience, and we can't really separate them out and only feel or only perceive or only know. They're kind of three sides of a triangle. Our experience comes in through these three aspects all the time. So we know experience, we recognize it, and we feel it. And that's a large part of how we stabilize the world, is through those mental processes. And then there's another process, which is around intention, around deciding, choosing what we are going to pay attention to, choosing how we're going to act, how we're going to think. Essentially choosing how we're going to feel. So these four processes stabilize our world so that we don't really recognize the rapidity of change. We don't recognize how fast things are changing. So that's that first insight, the fact that things are changing, and much more rapidly than we are usually consciously aware of. The second universal characteristic, is the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness. And this is about essentially our kind of universal wish to find some kind of happiness. And this aspect of unsatisfactoriness is acknowledging that there's nothing in our experience that can serve as a place for that lasting happiness, because it's all changing so rapidly that we can't really depend on it. What happens is that we try to depend on some of these concepts that we've created, the way that that information has come in and we've stabilized the world. We depend on those constructions, essentially, to make us happy. And so what we're relying on for happiness is processes that are occurring in our mind, not on something that's actually really reliable. Because these processes in our mind are prone to error, and they are also impermanent, subject to change. So there's nothing out there in our experience that can serve as a place of lasting happiness. There's nothing that we can really touch for long enough that it would make us happy. And this third one, this characteristic of not self, this is also a description of experience, that there is nothing in our experience that can be said to be I or mine. And this one is a little harder to understand. And so this is what I have been talking about for these last weeks. Essentially, in the easiest way to kind of conceptualize this teaching of not self is to recognize that what we think of as self, what we identify as self, when we start to look at it and turn our attention to that thing itself, we start to see that that too is changing. That there's no real entity, a solid, stable entity that can be pinned down and identified as me, or as this is what I am. So what we normally think of as self is actually a process. It's a process of these four processes I talked about, plus the body. That what we normally think of as self is this just river of changing experience of the bodily sensations, plus how we know them, feel them, perceive them, and decide about them. Or I should not rather say than how we decide about them, know them, feel them. How the process itself knows, feels, chooses, recognizes. So feeling feels, recognition recognizes, knowing knows. There is no one there, no entity there doing that process. The process does itself, much as if a seed is planted and the conditions are appropriate, that seed will grow into a tree. Is there an entity in that seed that creates the tree? It's a process. It's a process of lawful unfolding conditions. And that's what this mind-body complex is, a process of lawfully unfolding conditions. And what we normally think of as self is actually an add-on that our minds do. It's something that our minds create. this notion of self. So it's essentially it's a concept, this notion of self that we have solidified and stabilized much as we solidify and stabilize the world. So before I go on, let me stop there for a minute. see if there's any thoughts, comments, questions on what I've said. Yeah, Linda.
If we do the construct ourselves, you know, if we this kind of is, the seed germinates and grows according to the conditions, then how do we change I think I just answered my own question.
Well, this is good. I mean, this is actually something I want to point to. You know, if we really reflect on this as we speak about it, we can learn. So go ahead. Say what.
Well, yeah. I just find myself still falling back into the same patterns. And the same patterns of wanting things to be the way they always have been, or to have a safe, you know, things as usual. And yeah, I think I answered my own question.
So how did you answer your own question?
Well, that we just, you know, the process of meditation is to just let things be as they are, and that's okay. And so, and without any striving to get to someplace else.
Yes. So that, yeah, the process, essentially, yeah, the process of meditation begins to, with the instruction in our mindfulness practice, is to see if you can meet what is here, meet the experience, letting go as much as possible of thoughts, of ideas, of judgments, of opinions, of beliefs, of views, just as much as possible meeting what there is. And it's a slow process because we are seeing things through some subtle kinds of views, of beliefs, ideas that aren't necessarily obvious to us. And so we settle back, and as much as we can, we are with things as they are, as we can in this moment feel that they are. And yet, it takes time for those views to begin to reveal themselves as being views. This idea, in fact, this idea of self is so deeply embedded that it's nearly impossible not to see our experience through that view. So we just keep looking, just keep noticing, as much as possible. As I said last week, you can bring in a reflection. This is not me, not mine, not who I am. It's one of the instructions the Buddha talked about in terms of helping to undermine that view, to especially with things that are strongly felt as self. I mean, initially we start by looking at things that we really strongly identify with, like, for instance, anger or some strong emotional pattern, some strong thing that just seems to come up over and over again that we know isn't so helpful. We know it's not very helpful, but it's like we don't have control over it, and we don't have control over it because it's conditioned. So, for instance, anger arises out of conditions, and it takes quite a bit of awareness to see that process coming into play and not have it kind of do its thing naturally. So the process initially is around looking at these areas where we're really strongly identified. So we're strongly identified with some of these strong emotions. And we begin to recognize through just observing them how they come into being. And we see they do have causes and conditions. There are triggers for our reactions. And we can begin to let go of some of that reactivity. So through the course of meditation, we start to let go of some of the more obvious kinds of patterns that we assumed were just so deeply part of our personality. I had several very strong patterns that were really embedded, and I thought there would be no way to change them. And, you know, they're not there anymore. I used to think that I was a miserable person. You know, miserableness was kind of my mode of operating. And boy, that's not there much anymore. I hardly think it's there at all. I mean, so it's possible for these things to change. And so things that we've strongly identified with, strong patterns like that, we start to see that they are not me. They are simply conditioned patterns. And conditioning can change. When the conditions that create something are not there, that thing is not created. That's a kind of a basic tenet of conditionality. And much of what creates our mental reactivity lies in the mind. It's often there's some kind of trigger in our sense experience. Something we see or hear or something somebody says serves as a trigger. But it's not so much the thing that the person has said as it is our ideas and beliefs and views about it, how it means, what it means about me. That's almost always the way we take in information. So that's where we start. We start by looking at some of these more obvious things that we are strongly identified with. And those things can begin to fall away. So kind of the outer layers of our belief in who we are begin to shift and change. And then we come in and we're at another level of looking at experience. So some of the more gross kinds of delusion have been stripped away. And then we come in and we start meeting some subtler kinds of delusion. Just simply the kind of sense of feeling like I must be the one who's feeling, or I must be the one who's remembering. That there doesn't have to be a strong emotional reactivity to have this sense of I am. And it's a more subtle kind of exploration at that point. And then we just keep, the instruction is the same, just keep looking back at what is happening. What is happening here and now? Any other? Yeah, okay, good. Mike, well, you can go first and then Sophia.
I'm having a lot of difficulty with this concept, and actually I was here a few weeks ago and decided it was all a bit too hard and dropped out and came back today and it's still going.
Well, this is why it's still going, because it is a hard concept.
Maybe I'm meant to persevere. And I'm at a really basic level of, I keep coming back to when I make a meal, I feel it's my meal.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know why, I'm not really a foodie person, but, you know, my garden, I'm more the food, you know, I put the food together and it's the meal I've made.
Yes.
And I can't get beyond that.
Well, so there's no need to try to get beyond it. That's one of the things about this teaching, that it's basically, you know, just, it's kind of, what I'm trying to do is to open your mind to a possibility that things might be other than you think they are. And then all your instruction is to just pay attention to your experience. Notice where it feels like. So you've noticed this kind of particularly around food.
Well, sitting here, yeah. A couple of weeks ago, suddenly it was, I don't know why, the making a dinner each night. And I just sort of thought, that's my meal that I'm making for the family. And it's not even any feeling about it. It's just that it's my creation.
Uh-huh.
It's got me written on each plate.
Uh-huh.
Put together.
So there's the identification with the creation, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm a gardener, and the gardening, I get the process part. That's easier. Because, yeah, I'm very... My ability with gardening is pretty limited. I'm relying on a lot of other things.
So yes.
I got that this morning. That, uh-huh. that makes the me disappear quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
And the rain doesn't come and fertilize and the soil's wrong. But the food thing, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's you're looking at subtler levels of clinging there because... I mean, essentially the part that is clinging to is this part about choosing what to make, what foods to bring together, how to create it, how large to chop. I mean, it's all choices that are involved in that. And, you know, that part takes a kind of a quieter mind to begin to see that even those choices are conditioned. I mean, they are conditioned based on, you know, the ways that you've learned how to cook, you know, what your mother did or what your family did when you were a child, the kinds of books that you've read that offered you input, the pictures that you've seen that made you want to present a meal in a certain way. You know, so there's all kinds of input that has gone into those choices. And... You know, that there's no need to try to get rid of the sense of mine around it. But just, if you can, take a curiosity in what is this feeling of mine? That's mostly what I'm interested in exploring. It's not trying to get rid of something that feels so strong. In fact, the opposite. What I'm interested in doing is exploring something that feels strong. So turn your attention to that. What is it? So when you're preparing a meal, that sounds like a great exploration. What is the whole process? Can you be aware while you're preparing a meal? And notice particularly where that feeling of, oh, mine, comes in most strongly. Is it as you're chopping the vegetables, or is it as an image comes up in your mind that has the whole table laid out and everybody's sitting down at it, and that's where mine comes up. So see if you can notice where that feeling comes up. That's all that you need to do. You don't have to believe that it's not mine. You do not have to believe that. And in fact, that's kind of what the exploration of the Buddhist teaching around this that I want to get to today, is that it's not something to believe, it's something to explore. So, Sophia.
Well, I don't know, I was just thinking about memories. And so I was thinking, well, those are my memories. You know, these are very uncomfortable memories that are coming up during my purification going on now. Very uncomfortable, you know, thinking about certain things I used to do. And so I know it's coming up for whatever, whenever I can get to this technique. I'm still trying to do it, to try to get that out of my body. It's in there. Very unpleasant. So I was thinking, asking Andrea, what are memories? Let me think. Don't say anything. I want to see if I can work it out. Okay, maybe I just answered the question. Maybe it's a form of like stuck energy. Yeah, that would be it. So it's like there's a stuck energy. It's still not me. It's not self. But it's like, those are my memories from my behavior, and I don't like it, and I'm identifying with it, and I'm going to drag myself down with it. I'm going to react to it. And call myself certain things about, like, well, what type of person you used to be. So look how fast that went, just like that. You know, I could just drag myself. You know, I'm doing it all. I'm doing it. Who's doing it? Who's doing what to what?
So it's all a process again, and it happens kind of automatically. You know, that memory arises. Memory also comes often out of causes and conditions. If you actually look at when a memory comes up, I did this exploration as a child a little bit. I got very interested in where my thoughts came from. And particularly when we were driving in the car, you know, I lived in Texas and we drove long distances, so we spent a lot of time in the car. And so I played this game because I would notice that I was thinking about something. And I wondered, where did that thought come from? Where did that come from? And so I started trying to see if I could figure out where my thoughts came from. And so what I did is I played this game where I would pretend I wasn't playing the game. And then at some point when I recognized that I was thinking something that I was curious about, I would stop that, not thinking about it, and I'd kind of look at that and go, okay, where did that one, what happened before that? And I'd kind of trace back, I'd think back, what happened before that, what happened before that? And every time, you know, the more quickly I caught myself thinking about something unusual, the easier it was to remember the chain of events that had led up to that thought. And it was some associative chain that had almost always, I think every time when I was a child, this happened, it was always connected with something I had seen out the window. That chain had started based on some physical experience. Some sight, some sound, some smell. And then that chain had kind of taken off. That's not actually something that's so helpful to do in meditation, that kind of thinking back. But at least for me, it was very interesting as a child, you know, I was probably 7 or 8 at this point, to see that my thoughts, essentially I was seeing that thoughts were conditioned. They came from conditions. And so thoughts generally arise because of some condition. So look at that part, you know, notice that, okay, some thought arises. Then what happens after that is that we often react to that thought. If it's a memory of something that happened in the past, often all of the feelings around that happened in the past just come right up with it. And it's not so much actually that that those feelings are directly, they're connected to that thought. They're not the same as the thought. That essentially that memory arises, and then because we react to it in the moment, all of those feelings come back to us. I've told this story so many times I'm tired of telling it, but there's probably a lot of you here who haven't heard it, so I'll tell it again. So some years ago I was in a play, and one night in one of the performances I forgot a line in the play, and for a little while I tried making up lines to let the other people in the play know that I had forgotten, so that one of them would hopefully jump in and rescue me. But nobody did that, and so there was this silence, you know, this just deafening silence, you know, looking out at the audience and realizing, wow, I have no idea what to say. It was really embarrassing. So then fast forward several years later to a 3-month course. Something made this memory come up over and over and over again. And I was just watching this memory come up and feeling all over again all those feelings of embarrassment. So the memory came up, the feelings of embarrassment came up. And what became clear in my experience watching this was that there was a slight lag between the memory and the feeling of embarrassment. So I could see that the embarrassment was conditioned upon the arising of that memory. It wasn't actually dragged along automatically. It's created in the moment. The suffering that we experience is actually created out of a reaction that's happening now. Now, that reaction is pretty tightly coupled with that memory sometimes because perhaps it's been reinforced so many times that memories come up, the embarrassments come up, the memories come up, the embarrassments come up. So it's kind of a very strong pattern for that to happen. And so on this 3-month course, watching this over and over again, I got to the place where I could just see this is just the pattern. This is what happens. That it's not required that the embarrassment come up. I mean, I don't feel embarrassed now. The memory's right there. So it can actually get decoupled through that repeated process of just watching. So we start to see how the process of the mind works, this process of memory reaction.
Or just intellectually making a choice to disidentify. You know, don't identify with it, start labeling it. This is where we get into trouble because, you know, this is what Gil said. You don't have to be for or against. And, you know, my whole life was wrecked because I was, like, for certain things to an extreme and against certain things. And that's how I ended up here, and that's how come I love this practice so much, because we're going for equanimity. We're going for, you know, not going toward and letting something drag you forward or drag you down. You know, it's not necessary, and it's all not self. So there's
right.
No reason to really allow yourself to do it. But nevertheless, it has to be processed out through one or the other techniques, either, you know, Vipassana
it
or
It does
whatever.
Need to be processed.
That's what I mean.
It's not something that we're going to be able to just halt. And it's not something we can just say, oh, there's that memory. I'm not going to feel that embarrassment. Just that we can't sometimes, we can sometimes incline our minds towards letting go. But more often than not, we simply see, oh, there's that feeling and there's the embarrassment. And we just get to watch that process happen over and over again, enough that through the process of watching it, it kind of decouples itself. So that's at least my experience, that a lot of the practice is around this, just watching the process of things being created over and over again. Just watch, oh, boom, 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 just... That's how something gets created.
You just gradually disengage it from it.
It gradually disengages itself. Yeah. So, any other questions? Yeah.
Just a really quick. This is just very helpful and seems very meaningful. We've got a situation where a family member is quite ill, and we just have shocks, like an emotional shock and reeling, and you can almost feel like, oh, feelings trying to attach but not quite, or thoughts trying to figure things out but no way. And, you know, that seems like that's this process of kind of reeling from a shock.
Yes.
And it just seems very meaningful in the way you explain it. So thanks.
Anyone else? Yeah, here and then here.
We're talking about process, and what I've been utilizing in our discussions about not self, the number of ones that we've been having. As a therapist, I'm trying to help people. When we talk about process, I see it as liquid, amorphous, transformational, impermanent. And when we talk about not self, where I go to is, all these processes that go on are processes that go on in everything. Everything. We are all a part of it. And the life form that I have is a process that has certain changes and it will change to something else. From, well, if you take a segment of it, birth to death. But that's just, you know, instant. But when I'm trying to help people as a therapist and we talk about these processes, the thing that I've learned, one of the things that I've really learned most in coming here and listening to you is I find myself saying things like to help ease the not self concept. When something's happening, like anger, when someone will say, I'm an angry person, I try to help them practice anger is happening.
Yes, yes, that's huge.
Because it's a process that's temporary. And it's not, you're not an angry person. Anger is happening.
Yes.
And anger's happening now, later, before, you know, it's just happening. But it's part of that liquid amorphous process that connects everything to everything else.
Yes.
So it's a small way of helping people not suffer.
That's actually a big way. It's a big way. To just reframe that little piece is
and
huge.
I have to do it over and over again inside here and with someone who's reflecting. I find that very helpful thing to do is, you know, emotion is happening, anger is happening, confusion is happening.
That's a great way to at that outer level of looking at those things that we tend to identify with on that outer level of like, yeah, the miserableness, the confusion, the frustration, the irritation, the spinning, the reeling feeling, it's all happening. So anger's happening, anger's arising.
It's a process.
It's a process.
It's transformational and it's liquid and it's amorphous and it transforms to something else.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about memory is also a process. I mean, you had your way of describing it. I related to it in a way where, you know, I think of, well, you know, the brain has processes going on. And there's neurons and memories, very much like what you're saying. They're associations, but they're actually physical associations of neurons firing. There's a phrase that's out there now, neurons that fire together wire together.
Yes.
And that's why there's an emotional experience happening because there's an association that's probably, you know.
They're very closely linked.
They're very closely linked.
Yes.
And as you're pointing out, those things, when you can make a non-judgmental observation about, oh, this is associated with this, isn't that interesting? You actually are forming another neuronal connection, another kind.
And not only are you forming another neuronal connection, those neurons that have wired together are withering. Mm-hmm. They actually wither. Mm-hmm. The brain is very plastic that way. So, you know, if you continue to practice memory embarrassment, it gets stronger and stronger. If you can recognize memory, oh, embarrassment, interesting, rather than actually getting caught into the embarrassment, it somehow begins to decouple those wirings, which I find fascinating. You know, that to me, I saw that as an image at one point, and it's like, oh my gosh, that's like the clinging, that's letting go. You know, it's literally happening in the brain. The clinging is letting go.
But all in the name of relieving suffering, you know, if we keep working towards this understanding of the process of, as I've said over and over again, it's fluid and amorphous and transformational.
Yes.
It helps.
It does help.
Okay.
That's great. And Sharon?
Mary.
With Mary, okay. And then I do want to say a few more things, too.
You're going to be allowed, I hope. But I really got a lot of all that's said. It just occurred to me this morning that to view myself, I've been a striver my whole life, or striving was happening my whole life. I really, I really appreciate that space when I don't say I am. But what occurred to me really that I myself am just a process that's going on in the universe. That's an amazing insight to have.
Yes.
I went back east several years ago for a 40-day retreat, and nobody knew me. And I walked in, they didn't know how many kids I had, how many certificates I had, or any of these things. I was totally disoriented. It took me a long time. Well, a lot of it, I got across to them by the time the 40 days was over. This is who I am. That was very good for me to notice how disoriented I am by that. But this today, this is not disoriented. It's true. And it's a gift. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It is a gift, actually, because, you know, that process of selfing, that process of creating a self, is the same process that creates suffering. It's identical. So when we see, and actually that's kind of what I talked about last week, that if we can watch this process of suffering and see how suffering happens and get familiar with the process of suffering, we're doing the work about getting familiar with this process of selfing at the same time. We don't actually have to think about it that way, but as we get more familiar with this process and recognize that there isn't anybody here, it's actually quite a relief. It's very freeing to feel that way. So I want to talk a little bit about a couple of pieces that the Buddha talks about with respect to looking at this in our practice. And so I'm going to read you an instruction he gave to one monk who came to him and said, tell me about your practice, briefly, because I may not have time. I may not have much time. And he says, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. So those were his instructions to this person. Come into experience and as best you can meet seeing, hearing, sensing, cognizing. And that actually covers all experience. The seeing, hearing, sensing is covering smelling, tasting, touching. And cognizing is covering everything that happens in the mind. So in the seen is only the seen. In the heard is only the heard. Now this is talking about basically bare attention, meeting experience without the judgment, without the reaction. And if there is judgment and reaction, recognizing that too as simply something that is cognized. So memory, that's something that's arising. Embarrassment, embarrassment is happening. So that's just that process of just meeting experience. This is the practice of mindfulness. So he's describing in a kind of a very pithy way the practice of mindfulness. It's challenging to get to this place, to this bare attention. As I said, that it's a process of kind of unlayering all of these beliefs and views that we have about what's seen, what's heard, what's sensed, what's cognized. You know, initially when we meet what's seen, mostly what we're seeing is what we think about it, what our views and opinions are about what's seen. We may then start to get back to, I like or dislike what's seen, and see that the views and opinions are coming out of the liking and disliking. We might then recognize that, there's just this form and color. There's just this thing. There's just this chair. There's just this rose. There's just this person standing in front of me. And there's all of these views and beliefs that are happening around this person standing in front of me. So over time, we begin to kind of decouple and recognize views and beliefs that are operating and see that they are a process in the mind. So we start to recognize the difference between what's seen and the process in the mind around our beliefs, our views, our thoughts around what's seen. So this is a challenging process. And there's another teaching that actually describes very well what I've been talking about, this kind of leaping off of our experience of what's seen into thoughts and views and beliefs about it. And I'll read you, I need this one for that. I'll read you a little bit of this one. So he goes through in this discussion, he basically describes how this process of reactivity is born, essentially. And to start with, he's just describing it based on seeing. He goes through all the sense bases, but I'll just read the part about seeing. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. So what that means is that there's the eye, and there's something out there, a chair. And dependent on the eye is there, the eye is open, the eye is functioning, and the chair is there. Dependent on those two, there's this knowing, that seeing is happening. That's what that first line means. So that's a dependency. If that chair weren't there, I wouldn't see that chair. If the eye were damaged, I wouldn't see that chair. If the eye were closed or asleep, I wouldn't see the chair. So there's conditions behind the seeing, behind the fact that the mind knows it's seeing that chair. The meeting of the three is contact. So that's a kind of, so the eye, the consciousness, the form all come together, and that's a kind of a that's contact with the sense base. It's the distinction of the contact and the eye consciousness is pretty subtle to me. I kind of think of them almost together. With contact as a condition, there is feeling. So based on this form, the eye, the knowing, those three coming together, there is a feeling. It's pleasant, it's unpleasant, it's neutral. In this case, pretty neutral. It's a chair. What one feels, that one perceives. So this is talking about eye consciousness, feeling, and perceiving, or those three processes I originally talked about this morning, that there is the process of feeling experience, the aspect that when experience comes to us, there's some pleasant, unpleasant, neutral aspect, there's a process of knowing, and there's this process of recognizing. So actually, the eye and form, in the bare sense, in bare attention, is just form and color. There's no chair in that bare contact. Chair arises in this process of perception. I see that thing. I know I've seen those chairs hundreds of times. I've seen chairs in my past hundreds of times. I recognize it as a chair. Now I tend to recognize it as an IMC chair. If I saw that chair someplace else, it might not be a particular IMC chair, but I would go, oh, those are chairs like the ones at IMC. You know, it's so clearly recognized. So that's the process of perception. So I'll read that again. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. So that's the kind of basic process of just meeting experience. Now, the process of perception is a very natural process, and as I think I said last week or the week before, it's kind of like a shortcut. It's a way that we don't have to put together the information every time we see something to figure out what it is. So it's very useful, and it's not something that we get rid of. It's a place where we're more interested in understanding, oh, this is this process that's happening. Not to try to stop it, not to try to change it, but there it is, this recognition of chair. Now, this all happens really fast, so it's not something that we can really... we can see it happening moment to moment, but not so much in everyday life. It takes a little bit of a quieter mind. Joel, do you have something?
Yeah. Just an interesting thought about a chair. Imagine you go down to the furniture shop down the road and finish with your group here, and you go in and you see a purple chair and it says IMC chair. So it should be interesting. Is that this IMC? Is that another IMC? How do you, in this context, how do you start looking at that, perceiving it?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that's a lot of thoughts that would come in. And that's the next step. So, Sophia.
So I'm thinking, like, how would it be useful to, when you're noting, when you're, you're to separate those steps. So, like, I'm looking.
Well, so,
or should I? Is that something?
Not something you should try to do.
You don't have to take it apart.
Not something to try to do. If you try to do it, you'll twist your mind up in knots.
Yes.
I'm describing a process that can be seen, but basically in mindfulness we meet what is obvious.
Okay,
so you may be seeing things as chair. That's fine. You just notice seeing is happening, and you know what you're seeing. You know that you're seeing chair. So to get back to this, the next thing, so what one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. So that is where we start to move into this process of, we're starting to move out of the experience and into the mind. And often this process, this thinking process, begins to relate to me. I mean, now initially it can be just simply, oh, like there's a chair, and then, seeing it someplace else. Oh, there's an IMC chair. That's thinking about. It's gone beyond just the perception of chair and into, oh, that's an IMC chair. It might then move into, I wonder what it's doing here. Yeah. Then, oh, I wonder what it's doing here. Gee, I wonder if it is an IMC chair. I wonder if they've sold all those IMC chairs. Boom! That's the next step. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. That's where we really go nuts. This is the process, this mental proliferation is a process that the Buddha describes as being kind of the root of how we complicate our lives. This process, it could be translated as complication, that we complicate our lives and our thoughts through this process of thinking about, proliferating about. Now, this part is possible to watch. You're all familiar with this. I mean, as I describe this, you know what I'm talking about. So that's something that we can begin to watch. How does this process of proliferation begin? It usually begins with some simple thinking. You know, oh, there's a thing. Oh yeah, I recognize that thing. What is it doing here? Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, okay.
Are you saying that what happens is we start to get invested in the objects of the mind?
That, yes, you could say that. Mm-hmm.
So one could say, I'm investing. Investing is happening.
Yes, exactly. Or proliferation is happening. Exactly. And that is what's happening. Again, we're not trying to stop it. We're trying to recognize the process that is currently happening. Now, when we recognize this proliferation process with mindfulness, it tends to very quickly kind of disintegrate. Unless it's got a strong kind of impetus behind it or charge behind it. Often when we see, you know, oh, I've gone from a pain in the side of my eye to going to have eye surgery within the space of 2 seconds, it's like, oh, right, there I go again. There that process is again. You know, and we quickly see, oh, yeah, you know, that's just the mind doing its thing. And so it tends to fall apart. So it goes on here. So there's more. I know. I've got 3 minutes. So, what one thinks about that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source. Now, this sounds complicated. Perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset one with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. Essentially, what this means is that those mental proliferations become something, that's the kind of the formation of a view. It's the formation of a belief, of an opinion. And then from certain points, we then see our experience. Further perceptions of that, of something, become viewed through that proliferation. So this mental proliferation process gets really closely attached to the perception process, such that when I see something, that proliferation is kind of already there and being seen through. And that's where we really get stuck, because then we are no longer meeting reality as it is. We're meeting our minds and seeing things through that experience. So just meeting experience, meeting what we can of our experience. In the seen is only the seen, in the heard is only the heard, in the sensed only the sensed, in the cognized only the cognized. We do our best with that. And what we will start to see is that it uncovers these proliferated tendencies that then come into light. Now, it's not a problem when we see these proliferated tendencies come into light. It's actually a great thing, because if they're not seen, they tend to rule how we view things. But when they're seen, we can start to look at it more objectively. Is this something that's really true? Is it really believed? Is this something that's really... I'm a miserable person. Is that true? Or is this helpful? Okay. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions, so our recognitions and our ideas, born of mental proliferation, beset one with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. So it's 11. I had one more thing I wanted to say. Okay. So, to come back to this sutta, the Bahiya Sutta, the sutta that I started with, you should train yourself thus. Then the Buddha goes on after he's given that instruction, and he says, when for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized. So that's saying, when you have accomplished that, when you are perceiving things in that way, then there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This justice is the end of suffering. So what I take this to be or mean is that we practice this attention, we practice this mindfulness. We don't try to necessarily see things, not me, not mine. We just try to meet as we can, as best we can, and the scene's only in the scene and the herd's only the herd. When we strip down to just bare experience, we will understand this teaching of not-self. It's not something that we have to believe. It's not something that we have to try to do or create. In fact, it's more of an undoing. It's more of a letting go. It's an insight. It's an insight that happens. It's not something that we have to believe. So just meeting experience over and over again. And so with that, I'm going to say we'll start a different topic next week. 4 weeks is enough on this. I don't know what that will be, but see you next week.